Murder in the Rain, where each week Emily Rowney, Alicia Holland, and Josh McCullough tell true crime stories of the Pacific Northwest. Murder in the Rain contains graphic content. Listener discretion is advised.
In the early 1980s, a terrifying pattern started to emerge, young women and girls disappearing from the Seattle-Tacoma area. It would take a little over 2 years for most people to realize the severity of the pattern. When multiple bodies of strangled females were discovered in the Green River and surrounding forests, the media put the population on high alert. There was a prolific serial killer here in the Pacific Northwest. This week on Murder in the Rain, we revisit the case of the Green River Killer in preparation for next week's discussion with Nick Edwards, one half of the dynamic duo who hosts the popular podcast True Crime Garage. In July of 1982, two young boys riding their bikes over the Meeker Street Bridge, which stretched across the Green River just outside of Kent, made a terrifying discovery: the nude body of a girl floating in the water. The body turned out to be 16-year-old Wendy Lee Caulfield, who had been strangled with her own clothing and her body disposed of in the river. The last time anyone had seen Wendy was on July 8th, when she was spotted in the Tacoma area. After running away from a juvenile detention center in Pierce County, Wendy began participating in sex work to support herself. After the discovery of Wendy's body, the proverbial floodgates opened, and within weeks, the bodies of four more young women were discovered in or around the same river. 4 weeks after the discovery of Wendy's body, a worker at a Kent, Washington slaughterhouse found a body of a woman floating in the Green River. She had been strangled. Her name was Deborah Bonner. 23-year-old Deborah was last seen at a motel on Pacific Highway South on July 25th. She had been working as a sex worker. 3 days later, the partially nude body of 31-year-old Marcia Chapman was discovered in the shallow waters of the Green River. Marcia was a single mom with three children. It was hard for her to find a traditional job to pay the bills, so she started participating in sex work to support her family. The medical examiner who was at the scene estimated that Marcia had been in the river for about a week. Next to Marcia's body was another partially nude body, that of 17-year-old Cynthia Hines. After running away from home in Seattle several times and associating with questionable people, Cynthia was attempting to turn her life around. She was working as a cook in a barbecue restaurant in South Seattle. On August 11th, she was last seen leaving the restaurant after her shift. She had likely been abducted or willingly went with someone who murdered her fairly quickly because, according to the medical examiner, she had been in the water for multiple days. As investigators continued searching the area, they made yet another discovery: the body of 16-year-old Opal Mills laying face down in the undergrowth near the river. She was partially dressed with her own blue pants tied around her neck. Opal had dropped out of school as a teen, but had recently started a continuation school. The last time anyone heard from her was when her brother spoke to her on the phone on August 12th. That's when Opal told him she had an upcoming job with her friend Cynthia Hines. They were going to be painting together, likely houses. According to the medical examiner, Opal's body showed early signs of rigor mortis, which wears off in about 24 hours, indicating that she had likely only been dead about a day or two prior to discovery. During their autopsies, it was discovered that Marcia, Cynthia, and Opal were all strangled to death and had semen present in their bodies. Samples were taken and saved for future analysis because at the time there really wasn't much that could be learned from them. The cluster of bodies discovered in August were shockingly similar to Wendy and Deborah's bodies, and this prompted authorities to take action. It was clear that all of these women were likely killed by the same man. They had similar backgrounds, either runaways or sex workers. They were from similar areas, and at least two of them had known each other. On August 16, 1982, the Green River Task Force was assembled. The task force included detectives, forensic experts, local and state police officers, and the FBI. it became one of the largest and most expensive serial killer investigations in U.S. history. A notable person who was pulled into the investigation was FBI Special Agent John E. Douglas. Douglas was asked to develop a profile of the killer. In his profile, he described the following. The killer targeted street people and sex workers. He wasn't so much searching for a specific age or race. That didn't matter to him. These were more victims of opportunity. It's possible the killer pretended he was a police officer. He never felt remorse. He thought he was doing a service by ridding the world of these people. He doesn't want his victims to be found. He either worked, hunted, or fished near the river. He was likely an outdoorsman, someone in shape with a physical job. He wasn't meticulous or neat. He was probably a beer drinker or a smoker, or both. It's likely his vehicle was over 3 years old so that it blends in. It's not so old that it stands out, but it's not shiny and new to draw attention. His psychological history includes being raised by a single mom, difficulty in school. He maybe even dropped out of high school. He's likely average to above average intelligence. He's attracted to women. He's Caucasian in his mid-20s to early 30s. He won't ever stop killing. He's nocturnal and a cruiser. It's likely he's following the media coverage of the case. He takes trophies from his victims and might even give them to people in his life. We would learn later that this profile is a mixed bag. Some of the theories are right on the nose. Others are close, and some are completely wrong.
Emily, if you have this in front of you, what were some of maybe the bigger things that were most accurate and inaccurate?
Well, one of the things that we learned that was pretty creepy was the trophies. So he did take the trophies, and it was often jewelry, shoes, things like that. And he would give the jewelry to people like a coworker so he could see them wearing them.
Oh, that's so gross. I'm sure you told us that years ago when you first covered this story.
Maybe, because it was
stuff
shorter.
Like that is always just so extra gross because you're adding to the victimization.
Yeah.
Now that woman is a victim in her own way, being part of this gross game for him. That's so foul.
And they were right about the cars, but he also changed cars frequently, and he had a job painting vehicles so he could easily change what his car looked like. He did know the area. He did fish the area. He didn't really mind the age and race. His victims are typically younger, but he definitely had ones that were older. It was more about their life on the streets or their runaways, or it was just like you said, a victim of opportunity.
Yeah, so I was going to say, if he wasn't being picky, then it's just whoever he comes across.
Yeah, because some of them were coming right out of their work, right? And they weren't street people. And what's interesting that Nick and I talk about in the next episode is this idea of him being nocturnal that was really pushed. Like, people go for sex workers at night. Mm. That wasn't the case. A lot of the time it was very early morning because that's when he could get away with it. Like, hey, honey, I'm going to work early. Mm. You know, like,
well, and obviously people don't expect it. Even the professional is saying he's nocturnal.
And then unlike we talked about the Malala Forest killer and how he was always drunk, he didn't partake in that kind of stuff. He was sober. So it is a mixed bag. Like, some of it is very accurate. Others, it's like that's kind of the norm. So it's easy to assume that. And then the other thing that I thought was funny was the intelligence, because he's noted as having a low intelligence, even though and we talked about this the first time we covered this case. He did advanced things, like try to hide his crime scene with garbage and posed people and changed up where he dumped them. So he was thinking about it.
Like, the intelligence he had just happened to be
focused on this
for murdering people.
Exactly. Yeah. So I find that interesting. But yeah, I think a lot of it was pretty accurate, though. The deluge of bodies discovered monthly continued as time ticked on, despite the best efforts of the task force. In 1983, the bodies of 9 more women were located near or in the Green River. By 1984, the count increased drastically after 13 more women were found dead. While most victims still succumbed to strangulation, it seemed the killer had switched it up between manual strangulation and using ligatures. In 1984, victims were found in wooded areas rather than the early discoveries in the river. 2 years into the investigation, the number of victims had climbed to 26, and the task force was willing to follow any lead. They staked out the area known as the Strip, where many of the victims seemed to go missing from in SeaTac. They warned sex workers that they were being targeted and to share any information they might have on likely culprits or suspicious people. But they were also willing to explore more non-traditional methods of finding their man. After escaping prison twice and murdering a confessed 30 women, Ted Bundy was finally arrested after what could be described as a messy rampage killing in Florida. While he sat on death row awaiting his eventual fate, Bundy decided to draft a letter. In the letter, he offered his particular set of skills to help the Green River Task Force find their man. Who better to help them than another cunning serial killer? It's like crawling into the brain of the man you want to catch.
It's like Science of the Lambs.
It's exactly like that. The task force included detectives Robert Keppel and David Reichert. Keppel had worked on the Bundy case, and the pair decided, what the heck, let's go see what Bundy has to say. In the very least, maybe they could get more information about him, his own methods, and his victims before he was put to death. They still believed there were victims they didn't yet know about. Several interviews with Bundy took place, and he was more than willing to share his opinions on the motivations, behaviors, and psychology of the man currently murdering women in the Pacific Northwest. He most notably pointed out the following. The disposal site was near the killer's home. He would probably change his disposal sites. The killer was likely visiting the sites where he left the bodies, possibly multiple times, and likely engaging in necrophilia. Bundy went on to suggest that if they waited at one of the dump sites long enough, it's possible the killer would return to visit the bodies and even have sex with them. So if they waited there, they could catch him. What we later learned is that most of what he said was true, and had the pesky media stayed out of the active crime scenes, the plan to lay in wait and catch a killer upon his return may have worked. Unfortunately, the case was too widely known, and by the time investigators were a couple hours into a crime scene, the media had already been tipped off.
From what you know, would you say the FBI profiler or Ted Bundy had a better percentage rate of accuracy?
Ooh, I'd say they're pretty similar. There were things that Ted Bundy was saying that were more about him.
Right.
But in terms of the ones I called out, they were extremely accurate, but you can learn about them. Keppel wrote a book that Nick actually plugs in the next episode.
Okay.
So I'll leave you to hear it there because it's one of his favorites. But he talks about it in more depth, and I have yet to finish that chapter. So,
well, that's interesting. It's interesting.
Yeah. So from what I know, they're pretty close. But by 1986, the body count had almost reached 40 and it was continuing to climb. Over the many years that the Green River case was active, authorities had multiple leads and a ton of suspects. While there were several primary suspects being investigated, three stood out. One of the more notable suspects was Melvin Foster. The married five times 43-year-old Melvin Wayne Foster was an unemployed cab driver when he came into the spotlight. In September of 1982, Melvin went to the police with information on some of the victims whom he knew from driving them around in his cab. He also decided it was an appropriate time to offer suggestions on the psychology of the perpetrator. Thanks to a few classes he took in college, he thought his perspective might help police, which I love.
Yeah.
Just love that.
Hey, guys, listen, I have a podcast, so I'm pretty sure I can help you solve this murder, okay?
So what he ended up doing was providing the names of other cab drivers who may have been involved in the murders. So not my two birds, one stone, like let's catch a killer and let's get rid of my competition.
He had like a bad interaction with one of them. Be like, this guy, pretty sure he's a serial killer.
He's going on the list.
So while he puts their names on the list, he starts describing himself as someone that helped runaways. He helped them in exchange for sexual favors instead of money for their cab fare. So, and I'll remind you, most of these at this point are teenagers.
I was just going to say, weren't they all quite young?
Quite young. Now, the information he shared on the other cabbies and his own helpful nature actually helped line him up as one of the primary suspects. After all, he fit the FBI psychological profile pretty darn well. On September 20th, he failed a polygraph test. The other cab drivers that he told on, who were brought in for questioning, passed theirs. Melvin allowed police to search his house, which was roughly 50 miles from the SeaTac Strip. Authorities even placed hidden cameras in his home. which is kind of questionable.
Yeah, and horrifying.
But also, if you really truly believe that he's the guy, I mean, they were willing to do anything.
I feel like it's in movies a lot where the perpetrator is going to put themselves into the scene somehow. They're going to infiltrate, like they said, going back to the scene.
And being in the media.
And this is kind of that same idea.
It is.
Let me help. Hi, I know you didn't ask.
He was very involved. Like, clearly he had been reading about the case every day. And so he was like, red flag, just walked in here and offered his services. Now, he did let them into his house. He did give his blood sample. He was open with them. By September 25th, he was put on 24-hour surveillance, and this went on for over a month. And that surveillance showed him going back and forth to the banks of the Green River. When Foster decided to sell his car, he sold it unknowingly to an undercover police officer who paid cash and took the car to be searched for evidence alongside the blood samples from Melvin and anything else they found in his home worth taking and looking into. Now, at this point, Melvin goes to the media himself. And he tells them he's a suspect, despite the fact that there was zero evidence in his home. His blood isn't linked to them. He's just, you know, doing his duty and trying to help solve the case. Eventually, authorities who were once convinced he was the killer realized he likely wasn't because he was right. There was nothing linking him. And they ended up taking him out of that primary suspect lead spot. Another suspect who was on the police radar was William J. Stevens. William was of keen interest to police for a few reasons. He lived in the area many of the victims went missing from, the Strip, and he also traveled to many of the areas where the bodies were discovered. More suspicious than that was the fact that he used multiple aliases and had fake identification for each alias. People in his life also shared with police that they had heard him say he wanted to hurt sex workers.
When you say he traveled to those areas, do you mean those specific spots?
I don't know that for sure. I would assume the general area. I mean, it was broad. The bodies were dumped, as you can imagine, 26 bodies over a large space of time, 40 by that, you know, within a couple of years. So I can't say for certain. When his home was searched, his collection of police equipment was found. It included badges and handcuffs. And from all the true crime that we cover, we know that that sometimes aligns with the dude was pretending to be a cop. Am I right? So that's what the cops were thinking. They remembered one of the profile items that the FBI developed was likely impersonates law enforcement. After thoroughly examining the dozens of boxes of evidence collected from his home, interviewing his friends, family, and coworkers, as well as following up on his whereabouts regularly, they were unable to link him to any of the crimes and crossed him off the suspect list. The third primary suspect was Gary Ridgway. Gary had a history with sex workers and had been questioned regarding the Green River killings multiple times. In 1984, Gary participated in a polygraph test to probe his interactions with local sex workers. During the test, he was asked if he killed any women, which he denied, and he passed the test. Alarmingly, in 1987, it surfaced that he had been seen with two of the victims before they went missing, as in the last person to have been seen with them. At this point, police searched his homes and his vehicles. They also requested a saliva sample from him so that they could compare it to the DNA collected from the victims. However, DNA testing was nowhere near advanced enough to be of any help in 1987. It would be years and multiple missed opportunities before police realized that Ridgway was their man. Talk about missed opportunity. I can't recall exactly which victims it was, but there were microscopic pieces of paint found on several victims. And had they collected paint from his work clothes and like really looked into it, they could have matched it. And it's like, why didn't that? It was one of the biggest failures of this investigation were the paint chips. Because when they went back in 2001, it was obvious. Yep. I know they knew about the paint and they just weren't thinking it was a huge clue, which is just so frustrating.
Yeah, because everything at that point should be. With Mother's Day around the corner, are you thinking about a truly special gift for your mom or the motherly figure in your life? Let me tell you about MyLifeInABook.com. It's a unique service that turns your mom's life stories into a beautiful book. Pretty cool, right? Here's how it works. Every week, MyLifeInABook.com will send your recipient a question via email. These can be pre-written questions about, for example, your mom's life or any custom questions that you want to ask. And then she can either type her response or record her voice. And MyLifeInABook.com compiles all of her responses into a beautiful keepsake book. And guess what? They can even create an audiobook using her voice recordings. It's like preserving her voice and her stories forever. Imagine discovering stories about her youth, adventures, and the challenges she overcame. This book becomes a legacy, something you and future generations can treasure forever. Your mom's given you a lifetime of stories. This is your chance to give her a way to share them. Obviously, we love anything surrounding storytelling. It's what we do. So to be able to gift this to my mom, to not only hear her stories, but the stories of my grandparents and other family members, it will create a cherished gift for all of us to enjoy. Check out MyLifeInABook.com and use the code RAIN at checkout for 10% off. Create an unforgettable gift for your mom this Mother's Day. That's MyLifeInABook.com and use the code RAIN for 10% off today.
Gary Leon Ridgway was born February 18, 1949, in Salt Lake City, Utah. He was the middle child and least favorite child of three sons born to Thomas and Mary Ridgway. There seems to be a norm in the serial killer world that they're a white male with mommy issues, and that's definitely the case here. According to Ridgway, his home life was troubled. His relatives agree that Mary, his mother, was domineering and that there was often violence in the home. At one point, his mother was described in a police report as breaking a plate over his father's head during a domestic dispute. Gary's father, a bus driver and part-time mortuary worker, often complained about sex workers to his children and even told Gary stories about a coworker at the mortuary who was a necrophiliac and really took advantage of the job perks, you know, customers who can't speak or move.
He's telling his kid that?
This is a family member? Who is this?
Yeah, his dad. Well, no, his dad was telling Gary about his coworker who did that as he is a kid, teenager.
You mean how his dad was doing that?
I know.
So this guy at work, isn't that weird? Do you think that's weird or would you still love him?
Would you still love him? Gary had a bedwetting problem until the age of 13. He claims his mother would wash his genitals after he did it each time, oftentimes while wearing revealing clothing. I'm thinking like pajamas, probably. He told investigators that this contributed to him having conflicting feelings of anger and attraction towards his mother, and that he often fantasized about killing her. When watching interviews of Gary describing this, that is, if you can stay awake during the monotone drawl that he has, you'll be screaming Oedipus complex at the top of your lungs. Oedipus is Greek mythology about a mythical king who heard a prophecy, and even with steps taken to prevent that prophecy being fulfilled, he accidentally killed his father and married his mother, fulfilling the prophecy which brought disaster upon them. The term Oedipus complex comes from this story and was presented by Freud. It's a theory that at a young age, typically 4 years old, a complex mix of emotions in a child can turn into an unconscious sexual desire for a parent.
Ew.
Yeah.
What were once small signs that hinted at his future began to grow into an increasingly larger problem when he was 16. Think a neon sign that says, "I'm going to be a killer," flashing above his head. According to Gary, he led a six-year-old boy into the woods and stabbed him through the ribs, nearly killing him, but luckily the boy survived. When the boy asked why he did that, he said it was because he wanted to know what it felt like to kill someone. Now, I don't know if there was any evidence that this actually happened. And despite his regular fighting with boys at school and his questionable home life, he didn't have any juvenile criminal record. So I don't know if that's true. Or
yeah,
if he
there
was
would
just
have been something.
Embellishing.
The kid would have gone to the hospital.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that still kind of talks about his psychology. If mm-hmm. he didn't do it, he was at least thinking about doing mm-hmm. it. Gary had multiple failed marriages. He married his first wife, Claudia Craig, directly out of high school in 1970. He went off to the Navy, ultimately ending up in the final years of Vietnam. Both parties in the marriage stepped out on each other. Gary frequented sex workers while in Vietnam, and his wife had an emotional affair at home. He didn't take that news well. He felt betrayed and angry and even referred to her as a whore. Needless to say, their marriage was short-lived and their divorce finalized in 1972. He married again in 1973 to a woman named Marcia Lorraine Brown. They eventually had a son together. His son definitely became an important person in his life, and also a pawn he used to manipulate during his murderous endeavors. During his marriage, Marcia described him as having an insatiable sex drive. He tried to have sex with her sometimes 7 to 8 times per day, and this was often in public places like parks and in the woods. Investigators noted that Gary even brought his wife to some of the wooded locations that would eventually be where his victims were found. The pair got divorced in 1981. Towards the end of their relationship, Gary was arrested for choking a sex worker. This was in 1980. No charges were brought against him because he told police that the reason he choked her was because she had bitten him. And I like to imagine it was his penis that she bit.
Oh, yeah.
Now, the next year, he was arrested for solicitation. Gary married Judith Mawson in 1988, a few years after he swept her off her feet, making her fall in love again after a failed marriage. They were together for 13 years. She described him in a Daily Mail article as the perfect husband, one who made her smile every single day. They divorced in 2002 after he was identified as the Green River Killer and arrested for multiple murders. Nearly a decade after police searched Gary Ridgway's homes, cars, collected his DNA, DNA testing was finally advanced enough to offer assistance in the case. As a reminder, the Green River Killer was known to be active since at least 1982, if not earlier. By 2001, the case had been active for 19 years. Luckily, new techniques in forensic science were available and evidence was re-examined. The advances made were two new modes of DNA analysis, the polymerase chain reaction test, or PCR, and the short tandem repeat test, also known as STR. When used together, these tests allow scientists to copy very short portions of DNA. This is helpful when you only have small amounts of DNA, or like in this case, you're throwing up a Hail Mary in the hopes that old evidence can shed new light. DNA from semen found on four of his victims was compared to Gary Ridgway's saliva sample and proved to be a match. Now, this was pretty amazing because in one of those cases, they actually went back through the evidence and found sperm clinging to a single pubic hair. I never thought I would find those words so exciting.
Wow.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
All those years to go back and be able to comb that. And
just
then
that
have,
it doesn't break down even.
It didn't break down because they were so meticulous about how they collected it. And wow. Then to have a test that could be so specific. It's just so cool. I wow. love it.
Science.
Thanks to these matches, Gary Ridgway was officially arrested in November of 2001 and charged with the murders of Cynthia Hines, Marcia Chapman, Opal Mills, and Carol Ann Christensen. Carol was a 20-year-old waitress at a tavern in SeaTac. She was also a mother to a 5-year-old girl. The last time anyone saw Carol was when she was leaving work after her lunch break on May 3, 1983. She was supposed to come back for the rest of her shift and never returned. In April of 2003, Ridgway was officially charged with 3 additional murders, Wendy Lee Caulfield, Deborah Bonner, and Deborah Estes. 15-year-old Deborah Estes was last seen in SeaTac on September 20th, 1982, when she was spotted at a local hotel. Like some of the other girls, she was a runaway who was supporting herself with sex work. At the time in Washington, 2003, this type of case would have made you eligible for a death penalty, which we know from some of our other episodes was later voted against, and any death penalty sentence was commuted to a life sentence. But now with Ridgway up against it, there was a huge problem. After his arrest, he told investigators that he had likely murdered over 71 people, all of whom he had had sex with. Now, considering how many bodies they had already discovered, this was believable, and it was incredibly important to discover as many bodies and the identities of his victims as possible. So in order to convince him to share more information about who he may have killed, as well as where he dumped their bodies, a plea bargain was agreed on November 5th, 2003. in exchange for him agreeing to give, quote, complete, truthful, and candid information concerning the crimes he had committed in King County and answer all questions during interviews conducted by detectives or the prosecuting attorney, unquote, as well as pleading guilty to 48 charges of aggravated first-degree murder for the bodies they already discovered, his life would be spared and he would serve 48 life sentences consecutively without parole. So, a true life situation. He agreed, of course, and he did his best to help. In 2010, near a location where a body had previously been discovered, a skull was found in a ravine. It was eventually identified as 20-year-old Rebecca or Becky Marrero. The last time anyone saw Becky was on December 3rd, 1982. Her mother said she had received a phone call, asked her mother to watch her child, and then left the home and never returned. Interestingly, Becky was already assumed to be a victim because she had been friends with Deborah Estes, and police were aware of her missing status. Ridgway admitted to killing her, but claimed to have no memory of the details. He was charged with her murder, technically the 49th, in February of 2011. And more discoveries just kept happening. In 2012, remains that were found in Des Moines in 1985 were finally identified as Sandra Denise Major. A distant cousin was actually watching a Green River Killer documentary in 2012 and submitted their DNA for testing, and it was a match. How cool is that?
What made anyone think in Des Moines?
I think because they had family there and someone was missing and they wondered if it was their loved one.
As if he went out there to visit his own family.
Oh, Des Moines, Washington.
Oh, yeah, that makes more sense.
It's south of Seattle.
I see.
Yeah.
Never mind.
I love that, though, because other people would think it. So. But isn't that cool that they were just like watching and were like, you know what? That could be
that
my cousin. I'm going to submit my DNA. Now, Sandra was reported missing on Christmas Eve in 1982, and she was known to have participated in sex work and was seen entering a vehicle that day in Seattle. Remains that didn't have an identification were often given a number, and luckily, we now live in a time where there is a new way to identify them. My favorite, genetic genealogy. The remains of Bones 10 were found in 1984 in a swamp behind a baseball field near SeaTac Airport. Thanks to the DNA Doe Project, a nonprofit group of volunteer genealogists, as well as a close family member of the girl who uploaded their DNA to GEDmatch in 2019, a familial match was made. She was ID'd as 14-year-old Wendy Stevens. Wendy ran away from her home in Denver, Colorado in 1983. One of his last victims went by the names Bones 17, and they were discovered next to the remains, later identified as Sandra Denise Major, in 2012. In 2022, Parabon Nanolabs, who we've mentioned in many episodes, helped with DNA testing and was able to compare the DNA of Bones 17 to relations in their system, allowing them to build a family tree and eventually narrow down who she was. Her name is Lori Ann Rizbosnick, and she was 15 when she went missing. Bones 20 was finally identified last year, 2023. Partial skeletal remains were found in 1985, and they were identified as Tammy Lyles in 1988. And this was done using dental records, like old school style, like let's take the x-rays and look at them. Tammy had disappeared from downtown Seattle in 1983. In 2003, another set of partial remains were found, and it wasn't until last year that they realized they belonged to Tammy. So her body was spread over two locations. Gary Ridgway currently resides in the Washington State Penitentiary in Walla Walla, where he will likely die. There were a few years he was passed back and forth, and he served a short stint in Colorado at a high-security federal prison, but he was returned to Washington in 2015. Now, like many of these guys, during COVID, he had hoped to get a special parole, but thankfully, our justice system worked as it should and kept him where he deserves to be.
It's one thing with these lower level offenders.
Absolutely.
Or some of the people that they let out, which we have talked about, ended up reoffending, and that was the gamble they took. But there is no way Gary Ridgway, a household name,
a prolific, our number one prolific serial killer in the Pacific Northwest,
is going to be let out for any reason whatsoever.
I know. How DeLulu do you have to be?
Give him a chance, guys.
I think he had 16 of them when they were investigating.
He's been
reformed
his time behind bars. He'll do better.
Now, I know we didn't cover every victim, which is something we always strive to do on our show. But there were just so many in this episode. Well, we were going to make it one episode with my interview with Nick Edwards, but it ended up being a little long. So we have separated it into two episodes, and we're going to talk to Nick next week. And I promise you, it's a great conversation. He has an amazing voice. And if you've never listened to their show, you should check it out. I do recommend looking at our blog, because I will have a photo of every victim in the blog. And it's just, I don't know, look at their faces. These people were disregarded pretty much their whole life, and they were as important as any other victim we talk about. So go look at them.
And the span of his crimes, I think that's something, as a community, as the Pacific Northwest, I don't know that that has ever really been processed.
No, I mean, a lot of people don't know about him, which is always shocking to me, because it has been theorized that his victim count is at like 100.
Right.
There is a whole list that the task force developed of likely runaways and sex workers that he probably got, but their bodies have not been discovered,
right,
or he doesn't remember them because he rarely looked at names. He didn't care. It was
right.
Hey, there's a girl, I'm getting her and I'm going to kill her.
Yeah. And then just free to get away with it over and over and over again. Okay. Why would I slow down? Why would I only do it every once in a while if I can do it a couple times a week?
I mean, he was averaging every 5 weeks a body. I think that's the number. It was every 5 weeks. I mean, and there was a time. So his second marriage was, Nick and I talk about this, his second marriage was tumultuous, and that's when he escalated. His third marriage, he was actually happy and in love, so he killed less. But then again, we don't know that for sure, because
right,
we just haven't found the bodies. And
right,
Oregon is broad and expansive. Washington is broad and expansive, and he dipped into both.
Well, actually, in a couple of episodes, I will be talking to a family member. I did a True Crime Tuesday and got an email from someone saying we're this person's family member. And there was such little information. I didn't even know family members' names. You know,
right.
I couldn't have found anyone. So I was so glad they reached out. And because their sister was taken, they assume, because she just vanished, they became a private investigator. And they have said, and obviously we'll get into it in that episode, that they believe their sister was a victim of him. And it was in Portland. And she has reasons for that, which we'll get into. But part of that being, we don't want to panic in two states, in
right,
two major cities. We don't want Seattle panicking and Portland.
Oh, yeah. In their defense, I don't think he did it as often as some other, like I-5 killer, for instance. He was all
over
the place.
Oh, yeah,
yeah,
yeah. But no,
yeah.
I know, but just the idea of he's here now.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the boogeyman.
It was already a terrible time. I mean, we had Bundy, we had Ridgway, we had I-5 killer. I mean, it was very prevalent here.
Yeah.
Like, there were multiple serial killers active. Yeah.
And you just think about that. Even if, let's say, he only killed 26 people. That is such a huge ripple effect. 26
well,
sets
it was
of parents. 26.
49 is what
his 49 was the end.
Ultimate, what he went to prison for is 49.
Okay.
But they
so
think
let's say it's
70 to 100.
Only 50 and not the 100. I mean, that is such a huge number. People that knew them, they're so young. They were just in school.
Oh,
teachers,
yeah,
classmates, friends, family members, friends in that community of
their
sex work.
Their kids.
Their own children. So many people affected by the loss of one person,
mm-hmm,
times that up to 100, that is thousands of people touched by and affected by his actions.
And then think about the delay in, mm-hmm, getting your voice heard, because these were vulnerable people who were disregarded and weren't always investigated properly. So
yeah,
when they started to go missing, the pattern was picked up, but like, how long did that take?
Yeah, how many people had to report things before it was seen as an issue?
Now, a few of these girls came from, you know, a traditional neighborhood or traditional family,
right,
and they ran away, but most of them did not. Most of them were women of color, runaways, drug addicts,
right,
people
probably
who were doing sex
low
work.
Low income.
Right.
Yeah.
So I think that was hard on the families as well, as they're having to go and be like, I think my daughter could be one of them.
And all the cops are doing are proving his point or proving why he's choosing those victims.
Well, and it was the 80s, and we had the Malala Forest Killer here in Oregon doing the exact same thing, trolling for sex workers and killing them in the forest. So this was like a proven way to do what you want to do.
Yeah.
But luckily, the task force really helped people realize like, oh, wow, this is a lot of people missing in their sex work. Like, we need to do something about this. Not to mention, it was happening in Eastern Washington as well. We had two active serial killers in Eastern Washington targeting sex workers. So, I mean, what a horrible time to be alive. Yeah. And what a horrible time to be one of the most vulnerable population.
Yeah.
And that just, it riles me up. I get riled up because of conversations I've had with people who, they still have that less than attitude about these people. It's like, how do you judge a human life?
Yeah. And what makes you think you're not one step away from that?
Yeah, some of these gals are just walking home from work. So if you don't have a car, you're then you're a sex worker on the street. Like, right. Is that what we're saying here?
Or like, you wouldn't go to extremes if it meant putting food on the table for your kid?
Yeah, it's either that or you lose them. Like, if you have to make that choice, like, God forbid you do.
Isn't it an insane percentage right now that people are living paycheck to paycheck? It's like the most ever.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so your business closes, you lose your job, then you can't pay rent. Next thing you know, you're on the street and you're just trying to pay for food.
Yep.
And that becomes the only option.
And let's talk about this interesting new dynamic in our world. Sex work is almost on a pedestal these days.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's online. Mm-hmm. And these girls can afford their lashes done and their hair and their lip injections and new lingerie every day. And it's this like hip hot thing to do.
Yeah.
It's so bizarre.
Yeah.
It's just bizarre to think about because it went from being this frowned upon, dirty profession that you were a street rat.
Right.
To now idolize. There are young girls looking forward to turning 18 and opening an OnlyFans.
Right.
So it's just a unique perspective that I wanted to throw in there. But whatever it was, whether you had a drug addiction, you were trying to provide for your family, you were a runaway, their lives mattered. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people were affected.
And how fascinating to just now get an identification.
Oh, one woman, they came to her door and told her, and I think it was 36 years she had been waiting.
Wow.
I mean, can you imagine?
I guess at that point, who can say? You don't know till you're in those shoes. You would almost hope that it had been him because at least he's caught. You know, if something bad was going to happen to your loved one, for all those years you're waiting and wondering, and then they connect it to say, yes, it's confirmed that it's her. And you can go, okay, the guy has already gone through trial. He's behind bars forever. So he's not,
I'm sure there's a
boogeyman that's out there.
There's a part of you, though, that probably wishes you could have been a part of that. I think it would be, and this is my perspective because I am not in their shoes. A part of that would be really healing, I think, mm-hmm. to see,
have their name be part of it
and have them publish in the paper, art installed in Seattle about them. Like, a lot of stuff was done once he was caught that I think I would have wished I could have been a part of. But just knowing the truth, I think, is awesome.
Yeah. Well, I look forward to hearing your convo next week.
It's so good. I'm really excited. Nick is amazing. I don't know if they've officially confirmed Crime Con, but I am happy to tell you lovely folks, we have,
woohoo,
as of this week, we are confirmed.
Yeehaw,
we're going to Nashville in May.
That's right.
Join us if you want to meet us.
We're performing at the Grand Ole Opry.
I probably will be at a karaoke bar one night.
Oh, yeah.
But we're very excited. So keep your eyes on our Instagram because we will have a coupon code for you if you want to come and visit. And the hotel looks baller. So I'm excited about
that. It looks like a very cool hotel. I got to get some boots. I got to do some new boot goofing.
Well, you got to buy them there.
Yeah, I want to go to like a, what is that, Tommy Llama store? Llama boots and get a nice Stetson.
I have cowboy boots.
Yellowstone style.
I'm bringing my cowboy boots and my jean shorts.
Wow.
Oh, me too. But my jean shorts go to my knee and they have cargo pockets.
Oh.
So they're not
sexy. Well, mine show my butt cheek. No, they don't. But maybe my new ones will. Anyway, come see us at CrimeCon. I'm hoping Nick and the captain are there. I know that they are doing the UK one, so maybe we can convince them to do the US one as well. And please listen to next week's episode and meet Nick Edwards if you've never heard him before. If you have, you know how great he is.
Yeah, it's a good show.
Check, check, check. Yeah, there we go.
Oh, that's, I love your sound check.
Thank you.
That's actually his sex noise.
Oh, because I'm on the wrong fucking internet.
That'll do it.
Like a fucking idiot.
Yeah. Oh, you'll love that book, Em.
It's like a dissertation.
Like a school book with stats and graphs.
Oh,
and
my favorite. You know how to talk dirty to me.
When he said that, you should have said, I love you.
I should have. But I fucking panicked like a deer.
Well, yeah,
in
understandably.
That's just a shitty situation. That was terrible.
Yeah.
I love you, Daddy.
Ooh. Oh, but where did it go? Motherfucker.
This book is the data that this book contains. Very nice. Arrest conviction histories of violent crime and homicide cases by documentation status, Texas.
Because I'm like, that's not appropriate.
Oh,
maybe
yeah.
Maybe we can, though. We'll see.
We'll stuff it in the bloopers.
Stuff that joke right in the bloopers.
Oh, my God.
You ruined
it. Can you imagine?
It.
I'm like, yeah, so I dated this guy. We went on 2 dates at his home. I got knocked up. So we decided to get married and just see what happens. The task force included detectives Robert Keppel and David Reichert. That's it. The task force included detectives Robert Keppel and David Reichert. Reichert, did I say that right? Mm-hmm. Fuck.
Are you me?
The task force. I know. I'm having a hard time remembering. The task force included detectives Robert Keppel and. Oh, did I say that wrong? No, I did. Keppel. Oh my God. Now you're mixing up which one. Okay. A notable person who was pulled into the investigation was FBI special.
He's very special. Do you want to meet my special agent?
Not as special as Paul. I want him in my holes.
Oh!
I just made that up.
Well, I'll be sure to mention it to him at CrimeCon 2024.
Ooh, I'm tingly.
This is my friend Emily. She would like you, Paul, to be in her holes.
Murder in the Rain is a Cascade Media production, written, hosted, and edited by Josh McCullough, Emily Rowney, and Alicia Holland. Feel free to email us at murderintherain@gmail.com or through our website, murderintherain.com. For as little as $1 a month, you can subscribe on Patreon to get exclusive access to ad-free and older episodes. For only $5, you can access Patreon-exclusive episodes and content. For more of us, be sure to follow on all the socials, listen to Josh and Alicia on their other show, Always Be My Sisters, and follow Emily on TikTok at @M_murderinTheRain.
And suck my balls.